The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, and I'm very pleased to welcome our guest this evening. Now, I know that you don't often hear these two words together, but tonight we have a night of sensual pleasures. And if you've read books by either of these authors, you know what I'm talking about. By turns defiant, satirically hilarious, sexy, and wise, Ana Castillo is one of the preeminent voices of the Chicana experience. Vibrantly experimental in style, she has explored themes of feminism, oppression, and classism in a vast array of works, including several collections of poetry and many novels, including Peel My Love Like an Onion, the book for which she was last here, The Guardians, and So Far From God. Castillo is also a prolific short story writer, essayist, playwright, editor, and literary translator. Her latest novel, Give It to Me, tells the story of Moy Sexy Palma Piedra, a 40-something divorcee with a taste for adventure. Lambda Literary Magazine calls Give It to Me a must-read for all of us out there who have seen it all and lived. Tonight, Ms. Castillo will be joined by the longtime editor-in-chief of Gourmet, Ruth Reichel, the author of four best-selling memoirs, Comfort Me with Apples, Tender at the Bone, and Garlic and Sapphires, and For You, Mom, finally, the book for which she was last here. Ms. Reichel has been the restaurant critic for the New York Times and the food editor and restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including six prestigious James Beard Awards. In her debut novel, Delicious, a young woman finds herself the sole employee of a shuttered New York food magazine and stumbles upon a mysterious collection of letters written during World War II to a certain someone I am sure you've heard of. Will either of our heroines find their place in the world? There's only one way to find out. Please welcome our first presenter, Ruth Reichel.
So I thought I would tell you a little bit about how I came to write this book. When you're on book tour, and I am at the end of a book tour at the moment, you have these odd little moments of time where you're between interviews and between bookstores. And I usually go to thrift stores and used bookstores and I used to be looking for old cookbooks, but what I've started looking for is those little handmade cookbooks that people have, you know, where they pull out recipes and paste them in. And in one day when I was on tour for the last Gourmet cookbook, I found a whole stack of ephemera from World War II. And it was things from the Department of Agriculture telling you how to cook on rations with recipes that were mostly awful. things about how to plant a victory garden. Ads for the Women's Land Army, which I had never heard of, and the Crop Conservation Corps. And as I went through all these things, there was even a seed catalog from 1943. I got really interested in the notion of World War II as a time when we all cooked together. You know, it was the one time in the history of this country where it didn't matter whether you were rich or poor, you basically were eating the same thing. And I started researching World War II, alone in my hotel room late at night, I would research World War II. So I'm on this tour, and I'm in Seattle being interviewed by someone from the local paper at a restaurant, and I very politely turn off my cell phone and so he can ask me questions without interruptions, and suddenly I see the manager of the restaurant coming towards me, and he says, there's an urgent phone call for you. And I, of course, immediately think that something horrible has happened to someone in my family. My son has broken his leg. My husband's had a heart attack. And I pick up the phone, and it's my boss. So first there's this huge sense of relief, and then there's, why is he calling me in the middle of an interview? And he says, you have to come back to New York. And I immediately think, this is not good. And I say, you know, can you give me a hint? And he says, no, just, you know, be back here tomorrow. So I, of course, think I'm going to get fired. And I fly back to New York. And I was standing there with the staff when they told us they were folding the magazine. We gathered all the wine that our wine editor had collected and went back to my house and had a wake. And then the next day, the entire staff went back to Four Times Square to pack up their offices and start looking for jobs. I, on the other hand, had to go back on the road to promote the cookbook. It was really one of the stranger times of my life because it was not my book. It was Gourmet's book. I was not getting a penny for it. And all anybody really wanted to do was talk about how much they were going to miss the magazine. So I spent a month promoting this strange book. And then, of course, it hit the bestseller list because everybody knew it was the last thing they were ever going to get from Gourmet. And the minute it hit the bestseller list, the publisher said to me, okay, you've done your duty. You can go home now. So it was about 5 weeks after the closing of the magazine, and I went back to New York, and the first thing I had to do was pack up my office. And I went into the Condé Nast building, and where the big Gourmet sign had been on our floor, somebody had wrenched out all those metal letters, so there were just holes in the wall. And I started walking through this empty office. I mean, nobody had been there for 5 weeks, and people from other magazines had come down looting and taken things, and there were, you know, dying plants sitting on the windowsills and broken furniture, and every photograph the magazine had ever taken was in these big bins being thrown out. They were all crumpled and being thrown out. And it was so depressing that I went into the kitchen thinking, well, we had 8 test kitchens. And I thought, well, you know, the kitchen will be kind of comfortable. And I go into the kitchen, and they had locked the kitchen. But they had neglected to get rid of the food. So it was filled with rotten food. And I was walking, I mean, I saw an orange, which looked like the one thing in the whole kitchen that had not, that still, it was still sort of orange, and I picked it up and it just disintegrated in my hand. And now I'm really depressed. And I decide that I will go into, there is one room that I know is unchanged because the last thing I did before leaving on the book tour was to lock the library. Gourmet magazine started in 1941, and every cookbook that had been published in America since then had come through this library. And it was an intact library. So I went in there, and it was not a romantic room. I mean, the Condé Nast building was a soulless glass and steel building, and this was just a windowless office in the building. But I went in there, and it was unchanged since I had left. And I sat there with all these books breathing around me, and it felt comforting. And then I noticed, I looked back to the back of the room, and way in the back was a steel cabinet I had never noticed before. And I went over and opened it up, and in there was every letter the magazine had ever gotten. And I started going through the letters, and they weren't very interesting. Most of them were complaints about recipes. They were recipe requests or recipe submissions. But you know, my thought was, if I had the time to go through these letters, there's something remarkable here. There's a history of American food hidden in this. And it's really a shame because they're throwing away every photograph the magazine ever took. They're surely not going to keep these letters. They're just going to get dumped. And I went back to my office, and instead of starting to pack up, I sat down and wrote the letters I wished I had found in there. So this is the first of the letters that I wrote. Dear Mr. Beard, on the radio last spring, President Roosevelt said that each and every one of us here on the home front has a battle to fight. We must keep our spirits up. I'm doing my best, but in my opinion, liver gems are a lost cause because they would take the spirit right out of anyone. So when Mother says it's wrong for us to eat better than our brave men overseas, I tell her that I don't see how eating disgusting stuff helps them in the least. But Mr. Beard, it is very hard to cook good food when you're only a beginner. When Mother decided it was her patriotic duty to work at the airplane factory, she should have warned me about recipes. You just can't trust them. Prudence pennies are so revolting, I want to throw them right into the garbage. Mrs. Davis from next door lent me one of her wartime recipe pamphlets, and I read about liver salmi, which sounded so romantic. But by the time I had cooked the liver for 20 minutes in hot water, cut it into little cubes, rolled them in flour, and sautéed them in fat, I'd made flour footprints all over the kitchen floor. This is literally a recipe I took out of a Prudence Penny cookbook. The consommé and cream both hissed like angry cats when I added them. Then I was supposed to add stoned olives and taste for seasoning. I spit it right into the sink. Mother looks so tired when she comes home, and I just couldn't give her salmi for supper. So I buried it in the backyard and made her some fried eggs. I know that waste is wrong, but I had no choice. Tomorrow I'm going to try again. I have my eye on the peanut butter and lima bean loaf from a cookbook Mrs. Davis gave me, which she says is a, quote, model of thrift. That is why I'm writing, Mr. Beard. I know you could do better. Don't you think it would be a good idea if you wrote a cookbook for people like me who are just learning to cook? That could take a while, but in the meantime, I have a question. We're baking cookies at school to send to the soldiers, and I refuse to waste my sugar rations and anything out of these silly books. So could you please, please send me a recipe I can trust? I'll be checking the mailbox every day. Sincerely yours, Lulu Swan. So I literally sat there in this desolate office and wrote 4 years of letters from Lulu to James Beard. James Beard did, in fact, work at Gourmet at one point, and he was very generous with his readers. And I'm absolutely positive that if Lulu Swan had, in fact, written to him, he would have written back. So I took these letters and I put them away. And for the next year, I did really nothing but go back into my kitchen and just cook. I mean, I hadn't really been able to do a lot of cooking in quite a while. So I just went back in there and started playing around with ingredients and pretty much healed myself with cooking. And at the end of that time, I got a phone call from an editor who said, "Don't you think you ought to write a novel?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure I can." Because what I had in the back of my head was this, when I first started writing, one of my very first assignments was a profile of MFK Fisher, and who was my food writing hero. And when we were talking, she said, "Of course you want to write a novel. Everybody wants to write a novel. Every writer wants to write a novel." And she said, "But I couldn't do it." And I thought, if MFK Fisher can't write a novel, what makes me think that I can? But I'm saying all this to this editor, and she said to me, "Look, think about what you did when you were at the New York Times. Think about what you wrote about in Garlic and Sapphires, where you wore all these disguises so people wouldn't know who you were. She said, you weren't writing fiction, but you were living fiction. And all you have to do is do the same thing and put it on paper. And so she said to me, you know, who is it that you would like to be? And I thought, well, look, I've written all these memoirs. I certainly don't want to write about me. So let me think about someone who's the opposite of me. So I thought, I'd like to be 21. I'd like to be new to New York. I've always wanted a sister, so I'm going to take a 21-year-old who comes to New York to work at a food magazine. And I knew that somehow these letters I had written from Lulu were going to somehow work into this novel. And so I took Billy, this 21-year-old, and put her in jeopardy, which is what you do when you're writing a novel. And then I had the notion that somehow she would find these letters from Lulu, and that across time, Lulu would reach out, and this woman, this little girl who had lived 70 years earlier, would somehow be her salvation. And that's pretty much what Delicious is. It's about these two women. And I hope you'll read it and like it.
Thanks so much. Good evening. Buenas noches. I want to thank Andy Cahan for his invitation, and I'd like to thank all of you this evening for taking a little time out to hear about books, for loving books, for caring about books. I want to read a little bit to you from a small book. It's a little chapbook, lovingly put together by a one-man show in San Antonio, who's keeping a lot of poetry alive in this country, and I want to support that. He asked if I had approximately 21 pages that I could donate to the press, and they did this little special collection, and so I found some short pieces. In English, we say flash fiction or sudden fiction. I don't know that there was a word in Spanish, and I wanted to address that also, and so I gave it the word bocaditos, which goes a little bit with my co-reader this evening. Bocaditos means appetizers in Spanish. So these are little appetizers. My mother was mostly Purépecha Indian. She was also an American citizen, but she was raised in Mexico. And I want to read a little story sort of based on a family story, and it's called Chicken. When I was a child, my mother used to tell me chicken stories. She had a lot of them. The reason was that as a child working for those Latinos, non-Indios, she had to care for the chickens. One time, my mother said she was very hungry, but very hungry. Although it was her responsibility to collect the eggs from the hens, she herself was prohibited from having any. Usually, she said, they fed her atole in the morning, maybe at night too. In between, she might get a bean taco and a little black coffee. Well, that day, the family had gone to a wedding at the church. They left my mother alone, of course. The maid and other workers had gotten the rest of the day off. By that point, my mother was, by her own admission, becoming a traviesa. She managed to find trouble where there wasn't any. She went into the chicken roost and climbed up to the top to see if any of the hens had laid anything. One squawked, but nothing. The next, the same. The third, nada. The fourth, success. Her little hand grabbed hold of the egg, and she started making her way back down the handmade ladder when she lost her footing and fell. She fell right on her head and passed out. When she woke up, she heard the family had returned. The little girl realized she was doomed. She'd get beaten for trying to steal an egg. So she stayed there without moving and pretended she was dead. "Come quick," she heard after a little while. She had kept the egg safe, clutched in her hand, but then let it roll off somewhere so as not to be caught with it. It was the family's little boy who discovered her. "She's dead, she's dead," the boy called out. One by one, the members of the family came to see for themselves, but no one bothered so much as to touch her until the father came. He leaned over. He felt for her pulse and let her skinny arm drop. "Yes, she's dead," the stupid man said. "What are we going to do?" asked this stupid man's wife. "But are you sure? Try shaking her. Let's throw some water on her. Maybe she's just unconscious." "No, she's dead," the stupid man said. "Oh, this is terrible, terrible," the wife said. "You know that indios don't go to heaven." "Where do they go?" one of the children asked. "I don't know. Nowhere," the woman said, "unless they were baptized." "Was she baptized?" "Probably not," the husband said, who by then my mother figured was already planning on digging a hole to bury her. "Let's call the priest," the woman said. "It's the least we can do for the little savage." That's when my mother sat up. She was not about to let herself be baptized so as to go to the place where the Ladinos lived, and therefore she would have to serve them forever. The woman gave my mother a good beating just because she had given them such a scare. But later, my mother snuck into the chicken coop and found the egg and ate it. Thank you. This new novel was what I did my summer of 2012. The previous novel was called The Guardians. It was about a woman living in a little ranch on the U.S.-Mexican border. She was a 50-year-old virgin. One of the protagonists, sweet, loving boy, gets killed. So in this novel, nobody dies, and I make that made up for the virgin part. It's having a lot better time in 2012. She's a recessionista, fashionista, and from what I'm also reading, there's a lot of talk about her sexuality, her bisexuality. And she also has a little fling with her little cuz, Liz, little being an expression. This is them. "I miss you, baby. Most of his texts were like that, short and sweet and possibly sincere." She didn't know what to make of them. Bama would have preferred that her little cuz pick up the phone and make an old-fashioned call, although obviously he already had his cell in his hand when texting. Why was he calling her baby? She didn't text back. The current object of his affections figured he was sending texts out like e-blasts to every female who gave him her digits. One day, he sent a picture of himself, a kind of man on the street pose, no message. He was fine, no lie. But Palma already knew that. What conceit. She saved it to her phone. Another day, she got an animation of two kids on a park bench. The boy slid over and kissed the girl on the cheek. Hearts appeared like bubbles. That did it, Palma called. "Why did you send me this?" she pretended to be irritated. "What?" he said. "It's cute. It's to let you know I'm thinking of you." Palma considered the thought. Maybe time had stopped when he was in the joint and he thought he was still 22, the age when he got arrested. It's fucking childish, Palma said. She used the F word for emphasis. Another thing he did to let her know he was thinking of her was send cold hard cash. Not literally. It came in a cashier's check. Apparently, the 40 grand he mentioned that first time they met again had come through. The post-it attached read, "Your share." Palma deposited the 8 grand into her account. Pepito called and asked, "Did you get my gift?" She understood. "Yeah," she said. "It fit beautifully." Thanks to the Patriot Act, you never knew who might be listening in on your cell phone. "What did I do to deserve it?" she asked. "Whoa," he said, "whoa yourself." "Ain't that what family's for?" he replied. "How would I know?" she asked. "What should I do with it?" "Why don't you use it to take an art class?" he suggested. "No time," she lied. "Buy yourself that Chanel suit you always wanted," he said. He remembered. When she was in high school, she tried to sew one from a pattern on Abuela Singer. Sewing, as it turned out, was not her thing. And the discarded fabric in Abuela's hands made expensive seat covers. Depending on how thrifty she'd be and taking any page out of the Abuela book of ultimate frugality, from buying day-old bread to getting the kids' socks and underwear at the flea market, he'd set her up for 6 months. "We'll see, Pepito," she mumbled. "I don't go by Pepito no more," he who reinvented himself reminded his older cuz. That was a child's name. He was grown. "I go by Joe now," he said. "In prison, they called me Chi-Town Jose to distinguish me from all the other Jose's. But you can call me Pepito, prima," he said. She imagined the smile of white, even teeth made whiter against a reddish-dark hue. He had a smooth face. Palma began to trace it with her mind's eye, the square jaw and even hairline. "Tell me you love me," she heard herself say. It wasn't something she had ever told anyone herself. Maybe not even him as kids. Maybe she had. Was there a pause, a nanosecond hesitation? "I love you," Pepito said, with a voice that nearly sounded as if he had left his body. A macho had to be the loneliest creature on earth. He never let anyone in. Women mistook the aloofness as the result of a man being wounded. "Pobrecito," they said. And like the snake the old lady cared for, which once it was healed, people were surprised when they got hurt by such a man. Pepito's upbringing was no better or worse than anyone else's. But the macho could not let people get close because he perceived himself at war with the world. "Go to hell," she said. They hung up. Palma was at war too, possibly MIA, saving Private Piedras. She went to the stereo and put on an old CD. Whitney belted out, "I'll Be Your Baby Tonight." Thank you. I started writing a long, long time ago, and it just got out of hand. I started out choosing the lucrative career of a poet, and wrote poetry for a long time. So I thought to be a good poet, that's all I could do was write poetry. And then I realized that everybody writes poetry. Not everybody reads poetry. And nobody buys poetry. In any event, I just would like to share with you my one official love poem. It's in this book, I Ask the Impossible. The poem is called I Ask the Impossible. People who know me have told me, and indeed you do. If you're in love, let me know after this at the signing. It was my assignment that night under a starlit sky to write a love poem. Very difficult to write a love poem that's not smarmy, and after her lips were red and her eyes were like stars. I asked the impossible. I asked the impossible, love me forever. Love me when all desire is gone. Love me with the single-mindedness of a monk, when the world in its entirety and all that you hold sacred advise you against it, love me still more. When rage fills you and has no name, love me. When each step from your door to your job tires you, love me, and from job to home again. Love me when you're bored. When every woman you see is more beautiful than the last, or more pathetic. Love me as you always have. Not as admirer or judge, but with the compassion you save for yourself in your solitude. Love me as you relish your loneliness, the anticipation of your death, mysteries of the flesh as it tears and mends. Love me as your most treasured childhood memory, and if there is none to recall, imagine one. Place me there with you. Love me withered, as you loved me new. Love me as if I were forever, and I will make the impossible a simple act. By loving you as I do. Thank you.
Two terrific readings. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So the readings were the bocaditos. The questions are where we have a little more fun. Who would like to start us off?
This is for Ruth. I thought the choice of names, Lulu and Billy, I always wondered how an author chooses the name of their character. So how did you come up with Lulu and Billy?
Well, I didn't even realize until I was in the editing process that I'd used a lot of L's in both names. Lulu really was a gift. I mean, I literally sat down and when I wrote those letters, she was Lulu Swan. I mean, my husband's always saying to me, don't mystify it, but it really was, you know, that was her name. Billy is a name that I always thought if I had a daughter, I would name her Billy. I've just a name I've always liked a lot for a girl. So, you know, you get to invent these people and do anything you want with them. So you get to give them names you like.
How about you, Anna? How did you come up with Palma Piedra?
It was interesting. I just started writing one night. I was reading a lot of Bukowski, and I was reading the fiction. I'd read his poetry many years ago, and I just thought I would try to do a little raunchy, write a little raunchy. And for some reason, Palma came to my mind. Then I had to give a reason why she would be named Palma. It's not a traditional name. Palma Piedras. So it's palm rocks. So Palma, it turns out, since she's from the Midwest, her mom, who was a teenage mom, went to L.A. as a girl and fell in love with the palm trees in California, and so she named her baby Palma. So.
And the rock part?
The rocks is just because as you see, then you know, as a teenager, she's called Rocky. She's kind of a knucklehead in some ways, this character. So Piedras kind of went with the character. Yeah.
Okay. Another question in the fifth row there.
The brave section of the room.
Ruth, this question's for you. What did you do with the letters, the original letters, the ones that were criticizing, you know? And did you ever think of publishing those just to see how mean people could be sometimes or what people were thinking?
The letters weren't mine. They belonged to Condé Nast.
Oh, so you left them there.
So I had, you know, I seriously thought about taking them, but they would have been stolen property.
You couldn't have bought them or from them or. Maybe you just didn't think
of it. You know, I had actually suggested to Cy Newhouse that he donate the library to NYU, which has the largest cookbook collection in the country. And I will never understand why he didn't do that. I mean, but in fact, Roseanne Gold, who's a wonderful cookbook author, did buy the library and donate it to NYU. And I don't know if the letters went with it or not. My guess is they didn't. But it's something I'm going to check. I mean, my guess, I mean, look, you cannot imagine, they threw away hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of photographs. I mean, the photographs, so I cannot imagine that they hung on to letters.
Another question.
Yeah, well, two gentlemen on the aisle there.
Thank you for calling me a gentleman.
Ruth, I don't know you.
I guess that's why. Ruth, you're a master of disguise, and you presented it so well in your book. And coming here tonight, I was wondering whether you still tried to disguise yourself or make yourself up as someone else for certain occasions.
I have not. When I wrote For You, Mom, Finally, I did do my mom disguise one last time. And it was a very elaborate disguise. I was doing it for television, and it involved, you know, putting all this, like, all, it's some kind of theater makeup on your face. And, I mean, I looked so much like my mother in this disguise. I mean, I had her clothes and her jewelry, that when I took a photograph of myself and sent it to my brother, he said, "I've never seen that photograph of Mom." But in the time between leaving the New York Times and doing that, I had obviously developed some allergy to this makeup. And in the middle of the TV show, I had to go to the hospital and get it. I mean, I under this makeup, you could see that my face was starting to flame. So I haven't messed with any of that since then.
Yeah, forgive me, a little personal indulgence. But I found it very compelling when you described returning to your office after, what was it, 5 weeks?
Yeah.
And being the only one there. And the reason is back in the 60s, people here remember the 60s, I'm sure, I was a reporter for Look magazine in New York, and it's my first job out of college. And I spent many, many late nights at Look magazine at 488 Madison Avenue with nobody there. And when you told your story, it just brought that back to me just so indelibly. But the question I have for you is, when you described the Condé Nast building as soulless, my question is, and my daughter worked for a couple of magazines there for years, and I've been there many times. Was this before or after Frank Gehry redesigned the cafeteria?
Well, I mean, the cafeteria is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I understand that it's going to get scrapped when they move. But the rest of the building is, I thought, was pretty awful, actually. What I mean when I'm describing it as soulless is, in the book, I have put Delicious Magazine in a federal mansion, and I've kind of made the mansion a character in the book, and it's sort of where I wished Gourmet would have been. And I think I sort of was thinking in the back of my head, my father was a book designer, and he did a lot of work for Random House, which when I was little was in the Villard Houses, which is now the New York Palace Hotel, but a, you know, a fabulous, fabulous old mansion. And so, I mean, compared to skyscraper on the corner of 42nd Street and Broadway, I've made Delicious in put it in the Timbers Mansion, which is a federal mansion down in Greenwich Village. And so it's just, I was just really thinking of the contrast.
I have a question for each of you. What made you think you could become a food writer? And Anna, what made you think you could become a poet? What gave you each the license to pursue that passion or identity?
Well, I didn't get that license. I didn't apply for that license, I guess, and I still haven't. I told people for a very long time that I decided to be a poet somewhere between 19, 20 years old. And one day, my mother, may she rest in peace, was sitting in the audience in the front seat. You only need one family member in the audience to kind of set the record straight with when you're going to do question and answers. And so I started writing when I was 19, 20. I decided to write poetry, and my mother put her little hand up. And I never even knew that my mother spoke English. turned around and looked at a whole auditorium, and she said, "She's been writing since she was this big." So this was true. I had started writing when I was 9 years old. Upon the death of my grandmother, who was my caretaker, my mom had, I thought I was going to be a visual artist. I was drawing and painting, and my mom would tear open like the junk mail envelopes or give me the butcher paper where there's no blood so I could draw on there. And so she brought this little very rough tablet home that was with rough glue from the factory, which they used to put their quotas on. And I used that, it's yellow, very hard yellow paper. And I began to write these little verses around that time. And I knew it was something because all the children in the playground, Chicago Public Schools, wanted me to write something like that for their families too. So I realized that that was when I began to start writing.
How about you, Ruth?
Well, as I said in the opening of Tender at the Bone, storytelling in my family was highly prized. And I really believe I sort of learned to write at the table, because in my family, when you sat down to dinner, you were supposed to have some story of what happened to you that day to regale the other people at the table with. And, you know, everybody had, you know, somebody funny sitting next to you on the bus or whatever, and writing never seemed different to me than just telling stories. And you know, when I was doing social work, my undergraduate degree is actually in sociology, and when I was doing social work, they said, you know, your reports, have you ever thought about being a writer? And when I got my master's in history of art, and my professors always said, well, you know, you're not really so good at this, except your papers are really fun to read. And when I got out of graduate school and I went to New York, literally thinking that the Museum of Modern Art would say, oh, yes, we're looking for a new curator. In fact, all anybody said was, how fast can you type? And I had jobs that I hated. And a friend of mine said, you know, you're such a good cook, why don't you write a cookbook? And it never occurred to me that I couldn't. I mean, you know, today some people, if you went to a publisher and said, I want to write a cookbook, they'd say, can you cook? Who's testing your recipes? Where do your recipes come from? But in 1971, when I went to a publisher and said, I want to write a cookbook, they said, oh, write us a sample chapter, maybe we'll take it. I mean, it just never occurred to me that I couldn't do it.
Mm. Okay. Some more questions. Yeah, on our left, on the aisle there.
Hi, this question is for Anna. In writing a novel, different from poetry, I imagine that you have to think of the whole scene, the whole story. Do you think in Spanish or do you think in English? Like, how does that work?
I think that I must think in Spanish. I went to Chicago Public Schools, so I didn't go through bilingual education. So my writing is better in English than in Spanish. My mother taught me how to write in Spanish at home. But from what I learned about what critics have to say about my writing from very early on, especially in my prose, is that I must be thinking and automatically translating, because when you read the prose, you can see that the syntax is all different, and my prose reads like English in translation. But I don't realize it. It's just the way that I process the language.
Another question. Lady, yeah, about 8 rows back on our right. Just both folks in that aisle.
Eating and cooking, I think, are two very sensual things. So I'd really like to ask both of you, what do you love to cook and what do you love to eat?
Well, it's very simple for me. Nobody likes Mexican like Mexicans. I don't care where I travel in the world. I don't care what food I eat. I don't care where I'm wined and dined at. At the end of the day, it'll be Mexican. And so I've hand-built my kitchen in New Mexico, and so it all serves the purpose of, you know, tortillas y frijoles and, you know, all the things that you imagine, and the roasting chilies in the summertime and all of that. So that would be my number one thing, my number one reply, yeah. Thank you.
I love the physical act of cooking. And so, I love it all, you know, peeling a peach, the smell of onions caramelizing in butter, you know, the smell of chicken soup cooking on the stove, watching what happens with eggs. I mean, bread, you know, bread dough rising. I find cooking extremely pleasurable, and it's not like I like one kind of cooking better than another. And with eating, you know, I was a restaurant critic for 30 years, you better like just about everything, and I do.
What do you make of food as entertainment these days?
You know, I mean, I think what's happening in food today is fabulous. I mean, you know, people say, you know, oh, don't you think molecular gastronomy is silly? All I can say is, you know, I went to Alinea, which is the great molecular gastronomy restaurant in Chicago. It's art. It's food is performance. It's so much fun. It's so exciting. And, you know, I think it's fantastic that, you know, for most of human history, we've just been throwing protein on fire and calling that dinner. And now, you know, people are deconstructing food and pulling it apart and doing exciting scientific things with it. And it's a big kitchen. There's room for a lot.
I really love your writing, Ruth. But I have a question when it comes to writing autobiographies and fiction. Do you think autobiographies feed in some way off of fiction, or fiction feeds off of autobiography? And also, which did you prefer writing, your autobiographies or your fiction?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say biography, or memoir anyway, definitely feeds off fiction. I mean, one of the things that my editor said when she was trying to persuade me to write fiction, not that I needed a lot of persuasion, was your memoirs read like fiction, and I definitely tried to make that happen. Biography is different, because biography, you're probably saying everything, but with memoir, you get to pick and choose, so you get to make an arc, which is very much like fiction. I tried very hard for this fiction not to be biography. I loved the freedom of inventing everything. I think fiction is harder, but a lot more fun. I mean, you get to lie, you know? You just get to make everything up. It's fantastic.
How about you, Anna? How do you feel about that?
I have only written published a couple of personal essays. I teach memoir. I think it's very difficult for me. I will be starting a book of personal essays. But all novelists, all fiction writers always deny the autobiographical basis of their writing. But you have to remember that a fiction writer is by nature a liar. So having said that, Give It To Me is all fiction. And yes, I did a lot of research for it. So we just, change a few things here and there and try to pep up the story or cut back if we have to. So that's really what I think is basically the difference in the two genres for me.
Anna, often I enjoy listening to a book because I'm doing something else with my hands, just creating. And I just love the way you read tonight. Do you do your own, when you do audiobooks, do you read your own writing or does somebody else do it?
I am the voice on my novel, The Guardians. It's the only time that I've done it. The Guardians, as I said, was about this woman, 50-something-year-old woman, virgin, living on the border, U.S.-Mexican border. The book had just come out. I hadn't even read it yet. No one had read it. And I was very upset about this young protagonist that is killed. I was upset about a year before I actually wrote it because I knew I was going to write that. I was upset when I wrote it, and then I was upset when I got in that place, in that booth, in that studio. So I was already crying, you know, like 2 days before. And when you go, so all this is to say it's very difficult to record. So you can't turn a page if they can hear the page turn. You have to redo it and using a pen to do that. When I got, I was trying to hold it in when I knew I was going to get to that part. And when I finally got to that part, I was just weeping through that whole scene. And the engineer didn't stop me, and she's left it in. So if you ever do listen to the audio of The Guardians, that's me bawling my eyes out, believing in this poor guy, this poor kid who gets killed that I created.
You mentioned New Mexico, so I want to thank you for So Far From God. And
my pleasure.
And because of you, I sought out other Chicana writers. And I wondered, why have you made New Mexico your home?
Well, you read So Far From God, so... I think, a lot of people, it almost sounds hokey, but a lot of people talk about being called to New Mexico. That's one of these holy spots in the world. And I always knew when I was born and raised in Chicago, and I always knew there would be a time in which I would end up in New Mexico, and I did, without any other calling there. I did a sweat lodge, and I just knew I had to go there, and I wrote So Far From God almost immediately. I wrote it like in 6 months. Just arriving there. And then my mother grew ill, and I ended up going back to Chicago, and I started dreaming again of New Mexico, and so now it's been my home again for the last 10 years. But now I live out in the desert.
Well, please join me in thanking our two authors, Ruth Reichel and Anna Castillo. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.